The Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources is open. What we're going to do is I'm going to open up in just a minute a public hearing on House Bills 2210, 2211, and 2212 together, just because I'm anticipating that many of you that are out there that want to testify on biofuels will also want to testify on the other two. So we'll just do the three together. Then we'll go to Senate Bill 338 and Senate Bill 238. Now, you know, this morning is only public hearing. We're going to take all the testimony we can this morning. This afternoon, we're going to go to work sessions on the bills. And may not have time for public hearing this afternoon, so anybody who wants to say something on them, let's do it this morning. And I'm going to wait just a moment. Let's stand at ease because Sue is rounding up the list for us. That's okay. Yes. There you go. Nineteen people signed up for 2210. We've got 60 minutes. I know that some of the issues people would like to talk for a long time about, but let's be respectful, make sure everybody has a chance to put something on the record this morning since they may not be able to this afternoon. So keep your testimony relatively quick. With that, I'll open up a public hearing on House Bills 2210, 2211, and 2212. And Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I won't take very much time. You have a lot of suits in the audience for 7:30 in the morning. I appreciate that people are very interested in helping put Oregon on the map as a green state. We're already on the map, but it's been a while since we've made an impression on that map. I came here to tell the committee and you that we had introduced Senate Bill 316 from my interim committee on natural resources and alternative energy. I got an email from Thomas Endicott from my community, a co-founder of Sequential Biofuels, one of the first retail biofuel stations in the state, actually. Both he and Ian Hill started that company in their garage. A lot of great things happen in garages in Oregon, garage bands and now garage fuels. But we've now taken it mainstream. And when Sequential first started their business, they were only open on Wednesdays and Saturdays. And now they're open all the time and doing very well. And this is what I'd like to see for Oregon. So I'm here to tell you that we don't need Senate Bill 316 because the House has done an excellent job. I've kept in touch with those who've been working on the bill. It's a fine piece of legislation. We even visited, my committee visited the farm from which Sequential Biofuels gets their fuel, Kent Madison over in Pendleton. And it was great to see the farmer in action and how this bill can build jobs in Oregon and help us be energy independent. So that is all I'm here to tell you this morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think we can support Oregon farmers and retailers with this bill. I do want, while the energy tax credits are important, they are extremely important and critical to development of this industry. I just want people to remember to be very cautious about tax credits, and I really hope that we have some oversight in the department about these tax credits. They are very important, but they also need some strong oversight. So that is just my little tip about tax credits this morning, but I'm sure you already knew that. And I will not be here to testify on Senate Bill 338, my heat smart bill. My staff is here if you'll have questions for that later, and I expect that you'll go into work session on that this afternoon. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Senator, for being here. Appreciate it. Sue, while you're giving us an update on 2210 and the others, Mike Graney, you'll be up next. You want to come on up to the table?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, House Bill 2210 allows income and corporate excise tax credit for agricultural producers and collectors of biofuel raw materials used to produce fuel in Oregon, specifies the amount of credit per type of biomass, allows income tax credit for consumers who purchase ethanol blended at certain percentages, allows consumer tax credit for purchase of I think I just said that. Sunsets the producer and consumer credits on January 1, 2013, expands the local property tax exemption for energy production facilities that produce ethanol biofuels or verified fuel additives, creates standards for biodiesel, ethanol, and other renewable diesel to be monitored by the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and requires the Oregon Department of Agriculture to monitor biodiesel fuel production and ethanol production capacity in Oregon and to initiate minimum fuel blending requirements statewide for biodiesel and ethanol, sets mandatory percentages for ethanol and biodiesel for retail sales under certain conditions, allows for some exclusions to biofuel content requirements, and requires the Department of Energy to periodically conduct an impact study of biofuels, of the biofuels program. There's this comes from the House Energy and Environment Committee, and there's also a fiscal and revenue impact statement for all three bills. But if you like, I can continue with 2211. House Bill 2211 amends the business energy tax credit increase from 35% to 50% of eligible costs taken over 5 years. Provides a tax credit to home builders for installing renewable energy systems in homes and for designing and building high-performance, low-energy-use homes. Allows use of business energy tax credit and any federal energy tax credit for the same qualifying energy efficiency or renewable energy project. Provides that alternative fuel facilities combine heat and power facilities and renewable energy manufacturing facilities qualifying for the 50% tax credit, increases the size of hydro facility eligible for business energy tax credit from 1 megawatt to 10 megawatts under certain conditions, and increases the maximum amount of cost eligible for the tax credit from 10 to 20 million per project for renewable energy resources, including alternative fuel renewable energy manufacturing facilities. Places a sunset date of January 1, 2016 on the credit. And finally, House Bill 2212 amends the Residential Energy Tax Credit Program, increases the maximum tax credit for fuel cells and for wind generation from 1,500 to 6,000 claimed over 4 years, clarifies that the tax credit can be taken for each qualifying device if more than one device is required in the same year, makes high-efficiency wood stoves eligible for the residential energy tax credit.
Thank you, Sue. Welcome, Mr. Graney.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mike Graney from Department of Energy. Committee looks different when you're facing this way instead of your other.
You've spent a lot of time facing the other way, haven't you?
Is this our good side or our bad side?
It's always your good side.
Very good.
And thank you for hearing these bills, Mr. Chairman. These are part of the governor's energy package to complement the Senate Bill 838 that you've spent a lot of time on. Let me just make a few remarks on each bill, and I've provided a section-by-section summary for each bill for the committee as well. House Bill 2210, the biofuels package, is a package of measures that we're very hard on, starting with the bill from last session. It includes property tax incentives for production facilities. It also has a tax credit for producers and gatherers of the material that can be used for both ethanol and biodiesel production. It has a renewable fuel standard that's based on in-state production in the case of ethanol and for biodiesel, it triggers based on in-state production of both agricultural product and forest and farm waste that can be used for that material, so it will be assured of adequate supplies of the material in-state before the requirement for the percentages in the statute kick in, become effective. there's provisions to preclude use of MBTE and certain other oxygenates that are toxic, that are not necessary with the use of ethanol in gasoline. There's an income tax credit for consumer use of biofuel for E85 cars, B99 fuel for biodiesel cars, and for consumer use of wood material and high efficiency wood stoves. There's clarification of the land use laws that biofuel facilities that meet the current size limits and other requirements of the land use laws are considered a compatible use along with other agricultural uses in the production phase of crop production. There are other measures in the bill as well. For House Bill 2211, these are changes to the business energy tax credit. And as Sue explained, the most important ones, I think, are the increase in the percentage from 35 to 50% from $10 million a project to $20 million a project. This will have a substantial incentive, I think, and impact to help the development of renewable energy, including wind, geothermal, biomass, other energy that will provide options for the utilities to comply with the renewable fuel standard, or excuse me, the renewable energy standard in Senate Bill 838 that you just passed. So it's an important companion piece to that legislation. The bill also makes other changes to encourage renewable energy, provides a tax credit for home builders for incorporating solar energy and energy efficiency beyond what's required by code into homes as they're being built, which is the most effective time to do that. It increases the size of eligible hydro for use of the business tax credit. Currently, it's limited to 1 megawatt. This would raise it to 10 megawatts for new hydro. Or for improvements to existing hydro facilities. There's also provision in Section 5A of the bill that clarifies, and this that ties into the what we call the pass-through provision, and that's a mechanism that allows entities that don't have tax liability or much tax liability to benefit from the tax credit by partnering with what we call a pass-through partner that makes a payment that's the present value of the tax credit, and then that other entity takes the tax credit over the 5 years that normally happens for the under the business tax credit. And we've had utilities and banks and other corporations partner with small businesses, with schools, with local governments this program before to be able to get good energy projects for both energy efficiency and renewable energy. What Section 5A does is it's designed to protect the utility's pass-through investment by preventing the credit from lowering the amount of taxes paid that a utility is required to report each year under ORS 757268, and that's the PUC statute regarding adjustments to rates like taxes paid by the utility. Again, this section is needed to clarify that the investor-owned utilities can participate as pass-through partners for those entities that want to use the tax credit that don't have tax liability. There's been some question in the last couple of years that's restricted the investor-owned utilities' ability to participate, and it's a very important provision to them to be able to participate and to success the program for those individuals and businesses that can't use the tax credit directly.
Mr. Greening, Senator Atkinson.
So that provision will clear it up.
Yes,
for all.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, that's correct. That provision was drafted by our Attorney General consulting with the PUC staff and PUC's Assistant Attorney General, and we believe that takes care of the problem.
Well, and I'm very glad you brought it up because it has been an issue that I know has been bantied about amongst and around the building for a couple sessions now, and it should be very clear on the record that it would be the intent of this committee and of the body that the way you just described it, where the credit is prevented from lowering the amount of taxes owed by a utility company, is the clear intent in what we are doing with that section. So thanks for putting that on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then let me turn to House Bill 2212, the changes to the residential energy tax credit. This provides incentives for individuals for investments in their home for renewable energy and energy efficient appliances. Last session, you increased the tax credit for solar energy, for solar electric generation like photovoltaics, substantially. That is more expensive than the solar hot water heating, for example, or space heating. Similarly, fuel cells and wind energy, which have become more available for residential use for generating electricity, are also substantially more expensive. This bill would provide the same increase in the tax credit from $1,500 one time to $6,000 taken over 4 years for fuel cells and wind energy for electric generation for homes comparable to the solar electric. And it would also, I think most importantly, clarify that you can take the tax credit for more than one qualifying system in your home in the same year. And that's been unclear currently. And we've had situations where people have invested in solar hot water heating and solar electric, expecting to be able to take both tax credits. And currently, Department of Revenue says that under existing statute that they cannot do so. And this would allow them to do so. I should mention, too, that the two tax credit bills passed the House unanimously, the biofuels bill with only four negative votes. Senator Walker raised the issue of the need to closely scrutinize the tax credits in all three bills, and there are two tax credits in House Bill 2210, as well as the two business and residential tax credits. There are sunsets on all four bills, or all four tax credits. The revenue impacts are included in both the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget. And finally, when we were in House Revenue Committee, the House Revenue Chair directed us to develop metrics for evaluating the tax credits. So as the sunsets come up for review, we can evaluate each one performance measures and have copies of those, which I can leave with the committee as well if you'd like.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Graney. Are there any brief questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. On the definition of biomass on the first page of 2210, it mentions forest or range woody debris from harvesting or thinning conducted to improve forest range. I'm not going to read the rest of it. Would that commercial forest harvest qualify under that definition?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, it's my understanding that yes, it would.
And then the addition on page 3, to be for the tax credit purposes, again, have woody biomass collected from nursery orchard, forest, or rangeland property in Oregon included, but not limited to pruning, thinning, harvesting, planting, plantation rotations. Again, would all commercial forest operations qualify for tax credit under that definition?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graney. Appreciate you being here and giving us the overview very much. Commissioner Leonard, Joe Misek, and Rob Bovet. And just because of the, we've got another committee starting at 8:30 this morning, I'll need everyone to keep their testimony to just a couple minutes if they can, so everyone's got a chance.
Great. Thank you, Mr.
Commissioner, welcome. Glad you're here again.
Thank you. It's nice to be here amongst friends, and I've done nothing in my life I'm more proud of than having served in this body, so it's a real pleasure for me to be back. Last year, the City of Portland passed a RFS that will take effect July 1st, 2007, requiring all diesel sold in Portland contain 5% biodiesel and requiring all gasoline sold in Portland contain 10% ethanol. That ordinance was passed after developing great partnerships with a number of people in the industry, but particularly the farmers in Eastern Oregon, and more specifically the Pendleton Grain Growers Association, and with the great assistance of Kent Madison from Madison Farms. That will generate a demand of approximately 4 million gallons a year of biodiesel, which we hope to primarily come from regional farmers that grow canola. Second, the City of Portland is close to entering an agreement that would supply the city's fleet with about a 500,000 gallons a year of biodiesel. We are guaranteeing the farmers that will supply that product to us a minimum price, which they need so that they have the assurance when they plant the crop, somebody will buy it. We're doing also a financial package, $750,000 last year. It's proposed in the budget this year that we offer to folks in the biodiesel industry. For an example, we just awarded $200,000 to Sequential Fuels to create an incentive for them to build a outlet in Portland, as they have in Eugene, to sell their product. We are just thrilled, the entire council, and I will tell you that the vast majority of Portlanders with the prospects of House Bill 2210. It's really exciting to know that we are obviously doing something that's good for the environment, but we're more importantly infusing dollars into Oregon's economy and putting money into working people's pockets, including farmers that heretofore went to other large corporations out of state or other countries. So I really appreciate the work you have all done on this bill, and am happy to provide any assistance I can. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Avakian and members of the Senate Environment Natural Resource Committee, for the record, my name is Joe Mishek. I'm a policy analyst with the Department of Forestry. And on behalf of the Department of Forestry, I'd like to express strong support for House Bill 2210B. The Forest Biomass Working Group was co-chaired by the Department of Forestry, and in their report recommended that a production or consumption credit for renewable resources be considered by this legislature. In my written testimony, there is a listing of the key findings of the report, and this is one of those. Forest Biomass Work Group is comprised of a multidisciplinary group, including industry, state agencies, federal agencies, environmental organizations, tribal representatives, non-governmental institutions, academics, and other stakeholder interests. The committee ranges between 30 and 35 members. The $10 green ton credit contained in this bill for woody biomass removal will act as an incentive to improve forest and rangeland ecologic health and reduce uncharacteristic stand replacing wildfires. I thank you for this opportunity to comment on the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Thank you. Mr. Bovet.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Rob Bovet, Assistant County Counsel for Lincoln County. I'll be very brief. We have a similar bill, House Bill 2844, in the Joint Ocean Policy Committee, which would do essentially what you're doing here with biomass, except over there it's ocean wave energy. And we had a really good hearing 2 days ago on that bill, and it was suggested strongly by OECDD that we essentially come to you and merge those and obviate the need to do House Bill 2844. After examining the fine work that you've been doing on these two bills, I agree wholeheartedly. Spoke with Art Fish from OECDD. We came up with 2 one-line amendments that would simply clarify and add ocean wave energy to each of these two bills, and I provided you the sentence that we came up with for each, so I would encourage you to insert those sentences so we can dispense with the need to do House Bill 2844. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Maybe? Nothing? Senator Atkinson.
Commissioner, several questions. I'm very interested on what you feel from all the work you've done. What is the timeline that a bill or this bill and what the city of Portland is doing will be outdated? And what I mean by that is that essentially what you're advocating, which is very similar to what Seattle has done, is Seattle's made a market.
Right.
And in so doing, they've had a brief incentive period where the taxpayers have invested in, and knowing that, with all respect to all of us, I guess, government cannot keep pace with business, so right. That eventually this bill in Seattle will be outdated. What's your horizon for your bill?
I really appreciate that question, because that's part of the remarks I usually give to groups that are interested in this subject, is that I hope to make our ordinance obsolete within 2 years. And the oil industry is helping us as much as they can to do that by raising prices of petroleum fuel as fast as they possibly can. And what we're seeing is just precisely what you've identified, is what I still, even though we've made a commitment financially and it's big for us, I see it as minimal to get this market going. And I really believe that if oil prices continue going the way they are, within 2 years, the state's standing standard and our standard will have been met and exceeded as people begin to understand that, particularly in biodiesel, it is has all of the qualities of petroleum diesel, plus it adds lubricity to the diesel engines that was lost when sulfur was removed due to a federal mandate. It's actually a superior product to the current number two diesel petroleum that's sold on the market. So I think my own view is within 2 years we're going to be on the other side of our 5% mandate.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair, and that this goes to the overall policy question that for Oregon. There was some debate whether or not Oregon should move to one standard or have two standards, the Portland standard and everywhere else in Oregon, or move to potentially three standards. And that might be all theoretical now, but what are your thoughts on essentially creating two different standards, one in Portland, one outside of Portland? What do you think gets us to quicker outdated laws?
I think that that relates to the last question. I think we ought to be racing to the top, not to the bottom. We ought to be seeing who can outdo each other in the state, creating incentives for farmers to grow. As you know, looking into this subject, a huge issue is creating some confidence in the agricultural community that if they grow canola, we'll buy it. And right now, that confidence isn't there. By having us do 5% and you do 5%, and if Eugene did 8% and some other community did another percentage, that's, in my view, gets us faster to the place where the market takes over. I would also tell you that some of the arguments that when you have two different standards, it makes it difficult for the distributors to get the accurate amount is not true. They have developed, and we are using in Portland now, banks of distribution mechanisms that are computer operated that can, and you'll hear more of this from Thomas Endicott, I'm sure, that can precisely load the percentage of biofuel and diesel into each tanker that leaves with the ease of pushing some buttons. So we technologically have gotten to the place where it's really irrelevant what a particular retail outlet needs, because the distribution system is such that and sophisticated that I just don't think it's an issue.
Okay, thank you, you three.
Thanks
very much for being here.
Commissioner,
thank you. Roger Martin, Charles Corlson, and Thomas Endicott. And Lisa Hansen, meet me in the hall for just a moment.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent the Union Pacific Railroad, and I am here only, number one, to support the bill. We strongly support the efforts to develop biofuel and ethanol production in the state of Oregon. I want to just spend a couple minutes talking about the transportation requirements of this bill so you fully understand it. The initial raw material for ethanol will be corn from the Midwest, which can get here only by rail. It comes by unit trains, and you need to know a unit train is a train of approximately 100 cars permanently connected that travels as a single unit and brings corn or whatever into the Pacific Northwest. We've been doing this for many years. If you ever go down the Columbia River, or if Senator Atkinson were to go fishing on the river and you sit and watch the trains go down, it's going to be one unit train after another coming through. Most of those cross the Columbia River to a port just downriver in Washington where they're shipped to the Orient. The corn is shipped to the Orient currently for feed, for chickens and for livestock. Probably a far better use is to make ethanol. The Union Pacific Railroad strongly supported, and I think this bill is a good example of why Connect Oregon was a good idea. The Port of Boardman has built an unloading facility for unit trains, and unit trains require at the end, at the customer level, a circular track where the whole train can come in, be quickly unloaded, and turned around and sent back the other way. Unit trains can't be just parked alongside in a siding because it totally clogs everything. You've got to move these and keep them moving, and that's the key to unit trains. That's why they're the least expensive way to ship. But you have to have that unloading facility. We currently have at Boardman that kind of unloading facility. Pacific Ethanol, who we support, is building a plant there. We spent 2 days, the Union Pacific officials, with the port officials at Boardman to make sure they understand that a unit train unloading circular track must be kept clear. It cannot also be used for other incidental rail shipments of a box load of this or something, and that's what they initially were planning. We've got that cleared, Pacific Ethanol, and we're ready to start right now delivering corn to them. Now, part of this bill is a requirement for the use of ethanol as soon as it's triggered by the Department of Agriculture. We are prepared to bring unit trains of ethanol out here, but the key to all of that is the facility to which we deliver must be equipped to unload that. And currently, it is our understanding that most of the facilities in Oregon are not equipped to unload unit trains of ethanol. Yes, we deliver ethanol, probably more precisely the Burlington Northern delivers ethanol right now to the Portland area and other terminals. They come in carloads, several cars at a time, and can be unloaded at the leisure of the receiver. A unit train of ethanol is going to require a facility where you can unload the whole train and get it out of here. And the requirements of this bill, I've heard figures that closely or that very accurately indicate we shortly, when this bill is triggered in sections 18 and 19, will require unit train loads of ethanol to be delivered to terminals in the Northwest, either in Idaho, Washington, or Oregon. And I'm only cautioning you to make sure that the shippers can do that unloading. We're prepared to do it. We support the whole process, but don't ask the impossible of people to deliver something that can't be unloaded in the kind of quantities it has to be unloaded in. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Great. Good morning, Chair Avakian and members of the committee. Thank you. I'm Thomas Endicott, co-founder and managing partner of Sequential Biofuels. You've heard a little bit about our company. We've been involved in biofuels production, distribution, and retail in Oregon since 2002. We're also a manager and joint venture partner in Sequential Pacific Biodiesel, which is the first and to date the only commercial biofuels production facility in Oregon. And we're excited to have more coming on this year with Chuck's plant and also Pacific Ethanol and others. This bill has been about two things since the very beginning. It's about jobs and economic development in Oregon. It's also about increasing opportunities for agricultural growers in Oregon. You heard Commissioner Leonard talk about the opportunity to bridge the urban-rural divide with the canola oil from eastern Oregon coming into biodiesel in the valley. We have, in fact, processed canola oil from Pendleton grain growers and from Madison Farms in our Salem facility, and we'll do that on an increasing volume as that is more available. I'll also mention that Sequential Pacific will likely be the company that will trigger the biodiesel RFS for Oregon as we expand our facility to 5 million gallons per year later this year. This bill is about economic opportunity for Oregon and for Oregon business. We are an Oregon business based here. I just want to make the point that, as you know, Oregon has no oil wells. It has no oil refineries. And yet, we spend in Oregon about $10 million a day on these petroleum-based fuels. This is an opportunity to capture some of that money back here in Oregon. Also, I'll mention that I was a member of the biofuel subcommittee of the Governor's Renewable Energy Work Group, which was active during the interim. And much of this bill, in fact, almost all of it, was developed 2010, 2011, 2012. These were developed in the subcommittee and in the Renewable Energy Work Group. So there's been a tremendous amount of collaborative activity around this bill, both in that body and also on the House side. As you're aware, there was a lot of work on this bill on the House side. So the message that I wanted to deliver to all of you today is that this is a very good bill, and we're very supportive, and we'd like you to move it forward with no amendments and get it to the House, to the Senate floor, I apologize, and on to the governor's office. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Carlson. I'm the CEO of Cascade Grain Products, and we're a 113-million-gallon ethanol plant being built in Columbia County. We're served by the UP's competition, the BN, so we're receiving our unit trains from that side. Between our plant and the Pacific Ethanol plant in Boardman, we'll be able to provide a 10% ethanol blend for the state. Our combined capacities will be over 140 million gallons per year. Cascade Grain will be operational in the first quarter of 2008. We're under construction. Our construction pictures are under our website at cascadegrain.com. So I've been in this legislative session, this is my third legislative session down here looking for a renewable fuel standard and to remove the MTB as a blending additive and other chemicals such as that. It's glad to see that this is now through the House and into the Senate, and I really hope that we will look at a renewable fuel standard that will go quickly through the Senate and be signed by the governor. In a previous life, I know some of the in my previous life, I ran a grain co-op in Eastern Oregon, and there's been some question is how the ethanol has been used before, whether it comes Pasco, whether it comes from Portland. In Sherman County, we had three retail stations, and even back in the 90s, I used to bring ethanol blended fuel. At that point, we basically came from the Portland rack because that was about the dividing line. As you went further east of there, you brought from Pasco, but we did at times bring ethanol blended fuels from Pasco. Senex was our delivering carrier and primarily brought from Portland racks, or at times we did bring it from the Tidewater rack as well. So this is a very good time for the state of Oregon to look at renewable fuel standards. We are making much headway in cellulosic ethanol. I think that's going to be the big boom for Oregon down the road, whether it comes from municipal solid waste, ag residue, or forestry products. I was just at a gasification pilot plant just about 2 weeks ago, which was converting municipal solid waste to syngas, and then it could be converted to ethanol. And we are seeing commercial plants being produced, being constructed today that will be online in 2008 to prove this technology out. I think that's very much the future for ethanol as we try to get to the 35 billion gallons that's been proposed. Again, thank you very much for your time.
Yep. Okay, thank you, three of you, very much. Appreciate your testimony. Paul Romaine, Bob Russell, and Jeff Krupp.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm representing the Oregon Petroleum Association, and there's an old saying that came out of the Nixon era, which was just because you're paranoid doesn't mean somebody's not out to get you, so I'm going to be paranoid here and hope that somebody's not out to get me. We are just concerned, not opposed, on the ethanol mandate, the trigger. What you have in the bill in Section 17 is when capacity of ethanol production facilities reaches the level. That doesn't mean that production is going to be there. And we are the people who buy and resell the product. We like to sell the product. We make money selling the product. We're in full support of everything you're doing here. But we have to make sure that the supply is there for us. I don't know whether that was intentional or an error or whatever, but we would feel a lot more comfortable if the trigger was actual production, not just capacity, because you can have $40 million gallon capacity and zero production, if you take that literally. There's also no escape clause. For example, what happens once that trigger is hit, we are mandated to sell 10%. And what happens if there isn't a supply out there for us to purchase? We cannot sell anything else. And that's what concerns us. I understand there have been some folks that been talking about the capacity of Pasco, Washington's facility or Boise's facility. Our concern is the ability to draw the product that you are requiring us to sell. And so we would feel a lot more comfortable if there was some form of escape clause in there, even triggered by where the governor or somebody could say, all right, the product isn't available, therefore we can actually sell other fuel. Those are our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Russell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. You may recall that 2 years ago we were having this conversation about biodiesel and biofuels. And at that time, my members were petrified about biodiesel. That's no longer the case. My members, a number of them, are using biodiesel today. As Commissioner Leonard pointed out, it's a lubricity agent, and it helps with low sulfur diesel. They're also using it when the price of petroleum diesel gets up high, then we reduce the price by adding a blend of biodiesel. So we're no longer afraid of biodiesel. And the bill as it stands is just fine with us, except for a couple of omissions. Number one, when I talk with you folks and others in the building about a renewable fuel standard, we talk about a statewide standard, one standard for the entire state, which makes absolute sense. And then when I ask you, well, let's put something in the bill to create a statewide standard, then the response I get, well, Portland has a different standard. I said, okay, Portland has a different standard. let's do an exception for Portland. And then we get a lot of pushback from local governments. No, we don't want preemption, which is exactly why we would like something in the bill that creates a statewide standard. I'm very fearful that we will have numerous standards around the state, and it will be very difficult and expensive for us to get fuel. And the second thing that I'm concerned about is, as with Mr. Romaine, there is no escape clause here. Minnesota is the only state that currently has a biodiesel fuel standard. And they had some bad fuel that got into their system, and they had to suspend that twice. We have no ability in this bill to do that. Do I think we're going to get bad fuel? I don't know. But we need some way that we can protect the trucking industry in the event that something happens to the fuel supply. You know, the trucking industry is a very essential industry in this country and in this state. We're transporting 72% of the tons of freight in Oregon. Virtually everything that we have at some point in time travels on truck, by truck. We're very concerned that we haven't done a better job in protecting our fuel supply. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, I'm former State Representative Jeff Krupp, served with each of you in the House. Now the Executive Director of the Northwest Renewable Fuels Association, we're here to testify in support of House Bills 2210 and 2211. I've met with each of you. You know where I stand on this issue. We believe a lot of benefits, cleaner air, obviously, reduced reliance on foreign oil, plus stability from local production, insulation against some of the price shocks that we have seen. We've just seen that played out in the last few days with the Iranian-British troop issue and the price spike there of that. In fact, I picked up this weekend this little bumper sticker, which says it all for me. It says, biodiesel made in the USA and not in the Middle East. There's a great reason for us to continue to use our natural resources and opportunities here, both now with current technologies and in the future. That's what these bills do. They create tremendous rural economic development, and they lower prices at the pump. And they lower prices at the pump because they create a competitive, stable, local fuel market that benefits the people you serve, obviously. Let me address just a couple of things here, concerns that have been brought up. We believe, quite frankly, that there is no need to have unit trains of ethanol come to the Pacific Northwest. Because when this RFS is triggered, we will have one facility producing a rate of 40 million gallons per year of ethanol in the state of Oregon. That's Pacific Ethanol, which will go online in July of this year. It is not likely that the RFS will be triggered until after the beginning of 2008, sometime likely in the first quarter. You just heard from Chuck Carlson, Cascade Grain. They are on schedule to be online producing another 113 million gallons the first quarter of 2008. There will be local supply of ethanol available for local blenders. There will be no need for unit trains of ethanol to come out here to the West Coast. The trigger production, there's a great reason why the trigger was advanced, and quite frankly, because Portland's oxygenated EPA mandate has expired and will not be in a place next year. Without the mandate in place, next winter, we would have less ethanol sold in Oregon in the wintertime than there was this year, last year, and the prior 8 years prior to that. I don't think that's what we want. We want cleaner burning air. We want the incentives to make that happen, and that's what occurs here. The escape clause, we honestly do not believe that is appropriate or necessary, because the particular issue that Bob Russell brought up here a moment ago was involving Minnesota. They did not have testing standards in place when those problems occurred. We have put those testing standards in this bill at his request because he has a very valid point. Sequential Biofuels is in the audience. You heard from them, Thomas Endicott. They've been producing biodiesel for some time now with no problems. They're very careful. We know that this is a mature industry, both on the ethanol side, and we know it's mature, both on the biodiesel side. The processes are well known. The testing standards are there. ODA is going to monitor that. We know that that can happen. So, Mr. Chairman, in regards to PASCO, we also know that
last point, Mr. Krupp.
I'd be happy to do it, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. With regards to the PASCO terminal, we know that there are alternatives for there currently is blending their infrastructure all throughout the entire state of Oregon. There is blending infrastructure. There is ethanol blending occurring in PASCO today. And it is, there are many, many alternatives to that ability to be real whenever the RFS is triggered. And with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you, gentlemen. Lindsay Capps, Jeff Hildebrand, and excuse me, but Kay Courtgay, Wasco County. The Wasco County gentleman came the longest way, so he gets 2 minutes. The rest of you get about 60 seconds, which breaks my heart with my Washington County friend, but, you know, we want to make sure we get everybody in this morning.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Lindsay Capps, Legislative Director for the Oregon Environmental Council, thanks for the opportunity today to testify in support of both HB 2210 and 2211. As was testified to earlier, this is the these bills are the product of a long stakeholder process that I think took into account the values that Oregonians hold in energy independence, in rural economic development, and strong, healthy farms, in promoting healthy communities, and preserving our resources and quality of life. I think that's the bills before you today are a means to deliver on those multiple benefits. Both bills provide incentives and help establish a stable market for local renewable fuels production. It empowers Oregon farmers and businesses to develop these fuels, providing growers an added income stream and spurring new investment in clean fuel technologies. Biofuels feedstock production in Oregon and the Northwest can provide us a continual supply of cleaner renewable fuel that can stabilize our local energy supply. And this goes hand in hand with increased fuel efficiency, greater energy conservation, and new cleaner fuel technologies, and making Oregon, our nation, more energy efficient and independent. HB 2210 and specifically sets a standard for providing Oregonians with a cleaner burning renewable fuels that will improve our health and environment. Cleaner burning biodiesel reduces air toxics that contribute to a number of public health concerns, upper respiratory illness, cardiovascular disease, and asthma, of which there are about 58,000 children in the state who suffer from that. And ethanol reduces benzene emissions that have been linked to many disorders, including childhood leukemia. So this is a good effort for our environment. And I should add that biofuels use in tandem with other renewable energy sources such as wind, solar, geothermal, and wave that can be produced in Oregon will reduce CO2 emissions that are contributing to climate change, the transportation sector in particular being a large contributor to that. So for these reasons, we strongly support HB 2210 and 2211, and thank the committee for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Hildebrand. I'm here today to voice my strong support in favor of House Bill 2211. I'm here today as the Chief Financial Officer of Oregon Trail Wind Farm, LLC. This is a family wind farm that we are endeavoring to develop on our Century Farm in Sherman County, Oregon. My brother and I endeavor to develop this wind farm to produce clean, renewable energy, to provide also long-term living wage jobs in the county. In spite of recent developments and the expansion of wind farms in the county by PPM, soon to be Portland General Electric, Sherman County remains to be one of the more economically depressed areas of the state, which indicated by the 2003 U.S. Census indicates a per capita income level of $17,448, with almost 13% of the county at or below the poverty line. We expect that our 10-megawatt project will employ approximately 5 people on a long-term basis that will be expected to earn a salary of 1.5 to 2 times today's per capita income. While this may not seem like a significant impact, recognize that Sherman County has a population of 1,746 people with limited employment options outside of wheat ranching and cattle ranching. We are now at the juncture in our development efforts that require us to establish a relationship with an equity partner, most likely attracting investment dollars from outside the state. Increases to the Betsy's and the increase in the project cost cap, as outlined in House Bill 2211, are paramount in attracting this equity investment. All prices affecting the development of wind farms have increased dramatically over the past 2 years. Today, cost estimates to complete a 10-megawatt farm is in the $20 million range and more, depending on the proximity transmission lines and substation requirements. While it may be necessary to limit access to the Betsy's to prevent larger utilities from taking undue advantage, it is essential that the project cap be increased to $20 million for projects up to 10 megawatts to encourage development of locally owned renewable energy projects. Without passage of House Bill 2211, attracting equity partners for projects of 10 megawatts and less will be virtually impossible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your written testimony, too.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Casey Corchi, and I have been farming in Wasco County since 1965, raising wheat and cattle near the Dalles, Oregon. Recently, I've become involved with a project, a 10-megawatt wind farm project like the Hildebrand family on our farm property in Wasco County. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2211. We feel this legislation is necessary to ensure the continuation of our project as well as many other similar projects in the state of Oregon. We have jumped through virtually all of the necessary hoops to establish our wind farm, including data collection, wildlife studies, feasibility studies, transmission studies, site selection, FAA approval, Oregon Department of Aviation approval, financial and economic assessment, acquisition of a conditional use permit, and we have a power purchase agreement in place and ready to be signed as soon as turbines are acquired. However, due to our wind regime, the rapid escalation of turbine prices, currently at $1.3 million a megawatt, and construction costs, there has been some reluctance by investors to invest in our project. And without investors, our project cannot move forward. The increase in the business energy tax credits stated in this bill would move our project and others like it from mediocre to excellent and would greatly enhance the availability of investment funds for projects all over the state, thereby increasing the availability of renewable energy that we so desperately need. I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to present my views, and I would be happy to address any questions.
Committee? Seeing nothing, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming here today. Brian Doherty, Tom Gallagher, and Michael Mason. Actually, Mr. Doherty, before you go, we've got Senate Bill 338 up today. There's only two folks signed up, John Ledger and Andy Ginsberg, to testify, and I think you were mostly just going to go over the dash ones. We're going to skip that this morning. If you wanted 60 seconds this afternoon before we do the work session and pass that bill to go over the dash ones, we'll do it this afternoon. Although don't feel the need to do that. We're going to pass the bill out this afternoon anyway. Mr. Doherty.
Andy Ginsberg, I know what you feel like.
Don just walked in, so he didn't even hear me. Somebody fill him in. Sorry, Mr. Doherty, go ahead.
Brian Doherty of the Miller National Law Firm, testifying on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association. I'm here to testify on 2210, 2211, 2212. 2211, 2212, we support. 2210, we've talked about before. Our issue has been mandates. I'm not going to get into that this morning. You've also heard about the issue of preemption, and I just want to clarify one issue. What the city of Portland is doing, the state will be doing in spades here. This will be a much broader range, and it's a much easier range to handle from a distribution system. There's no question that with inline injection systems, you can blend B2, B6, B8, whatever you want. The issue is that the truck that's taking it only has three compartments, for leaded, for unleaded regular, for premium, and for diesel. And if you have to have B2 outside the city and B5 in the city, and you're delivering to multiple stations, that's a problem. That's the issue. We think have them make it like the state plan. We'll be fine. Going down the right to suspend, you heard, again, some testimony that there is no issue with Eastern Oregon, and I will address that very briefly. But I just want to say that there is a means to do this, and if there is no problem, and if biodiesel is as mature as everybody says, and there's not going to be any problems or any ethanol supply issues, then what's the harm in having the right of the governor to suspend this program if there is a problem that causes harm or is going to cause shortages in Eastern Oregon? The issue that I think you're hearing about, and I've heard people say that we question whether the Chevron pipeline terminal in Pasco and Boise really needs until somewhere in the third quarter of 08 before it can get there. And there is a comparison of someone being able to do this in 3 months or in 9 months. I hope you understand the difference between a bulk terminal that is delivering product to its own stations that has splash blending. That can be done in 3 months. You're putting a hose in the top of the tank and hoping it mixes in that truck as it gets to someplace else, versus inline injection systems at a multiple terminal that is a merchant terminal. Chevron Pipeline Terminals does not own the product in either Pasco and Boise. It has product it's delivering to more majors than just Chevron. It has other mines. It's over 4.5 million gallons a month going in from Pasco and Boise. They have issues that are different, and it's a much larger system than people believe, and people are talking about having one for a single company that has one set of fuels that it's doing. They are blending the additives to specifications for multiple companies there. It's a much more complex system than I think people are believing we have there. And again, they have to deal with the suppliers that are upstream to them from 7 refineries, and they have to deal with the issues from customers from 7 different majors. So I hope you will consider that. We believe a date certain in third or fourth quarter, or a governor's right to suspend, or picking anything else you think would work. But I think it would be prudent for people to do that and to make this as smooth a transition as possible to a very successful biofuels plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing Chevron. And I just say the Chevron Pipeline Company does not believe that it will be able to meet the timeline in the bill to deliver product to Eastern Oregon. Thank you.
Okay, thanks both of you. One more panel for this morning, Chris Beatty, Ted Hughes, and Tim Raphael. I didn't see Michael Mason come up. Oh, I called you a minute ago. You missed your opportunity, but if you... Perfect. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Avakian and Senators. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak again. Just here in strong support of 2210-2211, I'm the president and founder of an Oregon-based startup called Trillium Fiber Fuels that's working on cellulosic ethanol from Oregon-based agricultural products. And I want to express real strong support for two aspects in particular. One is the increase in the BETCI. This is a huge impact when we are putting together our proposals to pitch to investors. In terms of balancing the private equity money brought to the table versus the Betsy's a very elegant way with its pass-through to bring some additional funds to get an initial facility online. The other aspect I want to speak to very quickly is the biomass credit. In particular, when you're talking about residue products, whether it is forest or ag, while it does not seem like a lot at $10 a ton, it is a very pivotal amount in terms of dealing with transportation logistics. This is a very big deal in the cellulose world because you have what is typically a relatively low-density material, whether it's straw or thinnings or whatever. And that $10 is, more than spoken for in terms of just getting the material off the field and to the plant, or from the edge of the road in a forest thinnings, et cetera, to the plant. And so just to summarize, for us in the way we're looking at moving forward with the project, The package overall is fantastic, and we applaud your overall efforts in it. And the two most important things to us are the Betsy change and the biomass producer or collection credit.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Thank you.
Chair Vakian and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. You have my written testimony, so I'll be extremely brief. Pacific Ethanol is a ethanol production company with plants in Madera, California, and Windsor, Colorado, and a plant under construction now in Boardman, Oregon, that will be opening July 1 of this year. Pacific Ethanol's marketing group, Kinergy Marketing, has been marketing ethanol throughout the West and in Oregon for over a decade. And the one point I want to make on this is the most significant change we're facing now is not the blending of ethanol in Oregon. We have a long, successful history of blending, distributing, and selling ethanol throughout the state, and it's helped Klamath Falls, the Medford area, and the Portland metropolitan area to meet its clean air standards, reducing carbon monoxide and a range of other air toxics. The most significant change is that for the first time, we are going to have local production of ethanol. There will not be supply issues. Some of these arguments about supply are the same ones that were made when a switch from MTBE, which is contaminating water supplies, was made to ethanol to provide an oxygenate, to raise octane, and to provide cleaner air. We are now producing 5 billion gallons of ethanol nationally, and that number is moving higher every year as more ethanol facilities come online every day. We currently have 4 plants under construction. They'll all be coming online in the beginning of 08, and this is not a boutique fuel. It's standard, and Oregon has lots of experience blending it. Companies now are blending and selling the fuel and distributing it statewide. All of BP's gasoline has 10% ethanol in it year-round in Oregon. So with that, I appreciate your support and look forward to working with you on this.
All right. Thank you both, and thank you, everybody, for your testimony this morning. We appreciate it. And with that, we will close the public hearings on House Bills 2210, 11, and 12, and we are adjourned.
Carlson.